Her eyes rested intently on Lancelot's face as he said some polite words of greeting. He looked weary and travel-worn, his clothing ragged and not overly clean, a cloak of fustian worse than he would have given his groom. "Ah, the beautiful Lancelot! Guinevere will not find you so handsome now. Even I would not stretch out my hand to invite him into my bed." And then he smiled, and she realized, in spite of all, he is beautiful. "Shall we ride together, then, aunt? For indeed, I come on the most sorrowful of missions." "I had heard that you were on the quest of the Grail. Have you found it, then, or failed to find it, that you are so long-faced?"
"It is not for such a man as I to find that greatest of mysteries. Yet I bring with me one who did indeed hold the Grail in his hands. And so I have come to say that the quest is ended, and the Grail gone for ever out of this world." And then Morgause saw that on the pack mule, covered and shrouded, was the body of a man. She whispered,
"Who?"
"Galahad," said Lancelot quietly. "It was my son who found the Grail, and now we know that no man may look on it and live. Would that it had been I, if only because I bear such bitter news to my king, that the one who should be king after him has gone before us into the world where he may forever follow his quest unspoiled."
Morgause shuddered. "Now indeed will it be as if Arthur had never been. The land will have no king save for the king in heaven, ruled over by those priests who have Arthur in their hands." But angrily she dismissed those fancies. "Galahad is gone. Arthur must choose Gwydion to rule after him." Lancelot looked sorrowfully at the pack mule with Galahad's body, but he said only,
"Shall we ride on? I had not intended to rest a night by the road, but the mists were thick, and I feared to lose my way. I would have thought it Avalon itself."
"We couldn't find Camelot in the mists, no more than Avalon," Cormac began. But Morgause interrupted him fretfully.
"Have done with that foolishness," she said. "We mistook the road in the darkness, and rode back and forth half the night. We too are in haste to come to Camelot, nephew."
One or two of her men present knew Lancelot, and had known Galahad, and now they crowded close to the body, with soft expressions of sympathy and kindly words. Lancelot listened to all they had to say, his face sorrowful, then, with a few soft words, brought it to an end.
"Later, my lads. Later there will be time enough to mourn. I am in no haste, God knows, to bear such news to Arthur, but delaying will make it no kinder. Let us ride on."
The mist was thinning and burning away fast as the sun gained height. They set off down the road where Morgause and her men had ridden back and forth for hours in search of Camelot. But before they had gone very far, there was another sound that broke the strange silence of the haunted morning. It was a trumpet call, clear and silver in the still air, from the heights of Camelot. And before her, at the clump of four trees, broad and unmistakable in the growing sunlight, lay the wagon road built by Arthur's men for his legions to ride. It seemed appropriate that the first man Morgause should see on the heights of Camelot was her son, Gareth. He strode forth to challenge them at the great gates of Camelot, then, recognizing Lancelot, hurried to him. Lancelot flung himself headlong from his horse and took Gareth into a strong embrace.
"So, cousin, it is you."
"Aye, it is that.
Kai is too old and lame to be patrolling the walls of Camelot in these days."
"Ah, it's a good day in which you return to Camelot, my cousin.
But I see that you found not Galahad, Lance."
"Aye, but I did," said Lancelot sorrowfully.
And Gareth's open face, still boyish despite his full beard, was struck with dismay as he looked at the outlines of the dead man under the pall. I must bear this news to Arthur at once. Take me to him, Gareth.
Gareth bowed his head, his hand resting on Lancelot's shoulder.
Oh, this is an evil day for Camelot.
I said it once before. It seemed to me that yonder grail was the work of some devil, not of God at all.
Lancelot shook his head, and it seemed to Morgause that something bright shone through him, as if his body were transparent, and through his sad smile there was hidden joy.
"No, my dear cousin," he said, "you must put that from your mind for ever. Galahad has had what God gave to him, and, God help us, so have we all. But his day is finished, and he is free of all human fate. Ours is still to come, dear Gareth. God grant us that we meet it with as much courage as he."
"Amen to that," said Gareth, and to Morgause's horrified surprise he crossed himself. Then, with a start, he looked up at her.
"Mother, is it you? Forgive me.
Yours is the last company in which I would expect to find Lancelot." He bent over her hand with a dutiful kiss.
"Come, madam, let me summon a chamberlain and take you to the queen. She will make you welcome among her ladies while Lancelot is with the king."
Morgause let herself be led away, wondering now why she had come.
In Lothian she ruled as queen in her own right, but here, in Camelot, she could only sit among Guinevere's ladies, and know no more of what was going on than what one of her sons might see fit to tell her. She said to the chamberlain,
"Say to my son Gwydion, Sir Mordred, that his mother has come, and bid him to wait upon me as soon as he can."
But she wondered, sunk in despondency,
if in this strange court he would even be troubled to pay her such respects as Gareth had done. And once again she felt she had done wrong to come to Camelot.
Chapter 14. For many years Guinevere had felt that when the companions of the Round Table were present, Arthur belonged not to her, but to them. She had resented their intrusion into her life, their presence at Camelot. Often she had felt that if Arthur were not surrounded by the court, perhaps they might have had a life happier than the one they led as king and queen of Camelot. And yet, in this year of the Grail quest, she began to realise that she had been fortunate after all, for Camelot was like a village of ghosts with all the companions departed, and Arthur, the ghost who haunted Camelot, moving silently through the deserted castle. It wasn't that she took no pleasure in Arthur's company when at last it was entirely hers. It was only now that she came to understand how much of his very being he had poured into his legions and the building of Camelot. He showed her ungrudging courtesy and kindness, and she had more of his company than ever she had had in all the long years of war, or the years of peace that followed them. But it was as if some part of him was absent with his companions, wherever they might be, and only a small fraction of the man himself was here with her. She loved Arthur the man no less than Arthur the king, but she realised now how much less was the man without the business of kingship into which he had put so much of his life. And she was ashamed that she could notice it. They never spoke of those who were absent. In that year of the Grail quest they lived quietly, and in peace from day to day, speaking only of everyday things, of bread and meat, of fruits from the orchard or wine from the cellars, of a new cloak or the clasp of a shoe. And once, looking around the empty chamber of the Round Table, he said,
"Should we have it put away until they return, my love? Even in this great chamber there is small room to move, and now when it is all empty..."
"No," she said quickly. "No, my dear, leave it. This great room was built for the Round Table, and without it, it would be like an empty barn. Leave it. You and I and the household folk can dine in the smaller chamber." He smiled at her, and she knew he was glad she had said that.
and when the knights return from the quest, we can once again make a great feast there," he said,
but then fell silent, and she knew he was wondering how many would ever return. Kai was with them, and old Lucan, and two or three of the companions who were old or infirm or nursing old wounds. And Gwydion, Mordred, as he was now called, was always with them, like a grown son. Often Guinevere looked on him and thought, "This is the son I might have borne to Lancelot." And heat went scalding and flooding through her whole body, leaving her broken into a hot sweat as she thought of that night when Arthur himself had thrust her into Lancelot's arms. And indeed, this heat came often now and went, so that she never knew whether a room was hot or cold, or whether it was this strange sudden heat from within. Gwydion was gentle and deferential to her, calling her always lady, or sometimes shyly, aunt. The very shyness with which he used this term of family closeness warmed her and made him dear to her. He was like to Lancelot, too, but more silent and less light of heart. Where Lancelot had ever been ready with a jest or play on words, Gwydion smiled, and was always ready with some wit like a blow or the thrust of a needle. His wit was wicked, but she couldn't but laugh when he made some cruel jest. One night, when their shrunken company was at dinner, Arthur said,
"Until Lancelot comes back to us, nephew, I would have you take his post and be my captain of horse."
Gwydion chuckled.
"Light enough will that duty be, my uncle and my lord. There are few horses in that stable now. The finest horses in your stables went with your knights and companions. And who knows, indeed, whether or no some horse will be the one to find that grail they seek."
"Oh, hush," Guinevere said. "You must not make fun of their quest."
"Why not, aunt? Again and again the priests tell us that we are the sheep of our lord's pasture. And if a sheep may seek a spiritual presence, why, I've always thought a horse a nobler beast than any sheep. So who's to say whether or no the nobler beast may achieve the quest? Even some scarred old warhorse may come at last to seek spiritual repose, as they say the lion shall one day lie down beside the lamb and never think it dinner time."
Arthur laughed uneasily.
"Will we need our horses again for war? Since Mount Baden, God be praised, we have had peace in the land."
"Save for Lucius," Gwydion said.
"And if I've learned one thing in my life, it is that peace is something which cannot last. Wild Northmen in dragon ships are landing on the coast, and when men cry out for Arthur's legions to defend them, the answer comes only that Arthur's companions have ridden away to seek their souls' peace. And so they seek for help from the Saxon kings in the south. But no doubt, when this quest is done, they will look once more to Arthur and to Camelot. And it seems to me that war horses might be in short supply when that day comes. Lancelot is so busy with the Grail and his other deeds that he has had little time to see to the king's stables."
"Well, I've told you. I wished you to fill that place," said Arthur.
And it struck Guinevere that his tone sounded peevish and old, without the strength it once held.
"As captain of horse, you have authority to send for horses in my name. Lancelot used to deal with traders from somewhere to the south, beyond Brittany." "As I shall do also, then," said Gwydion. "There were no horses like the horses from Spain. But now, my uncle and my lord, the best horses come from further still. The Spaniards themselves buy horses from Africa, from a desert country there. Now, these Saracens are beginning to overrun Spain itself. This I heard from yonder Saracen knight, Palomides, who journeyed here and was guested for a time, then rode away to see what adventure there might be among the Saxons. He's not a Christian, and it seems strange to him that all these knights should ride away after the Grail when there was war in the land."
"I spoke to Palomides," said Arthur. "He had a sword from that southern country of Spanish steel. I would gladly have had one like to it, though I think it no finer than Excalibur.
No sword in our country will hold such an edge, like a razor. I'm glad I never had to face such a sword in the lists. The Northmen have great axes and clubs, but their weapons are not so good even as the Saxon weapons.
They are fierce fighters, though, said Gwydion. They go into a madness of fighting, as sometimes the tribesmen of Lothian used to do, casting away their shields in battle.
No, my king, we may have had peace for a goodly time, but even as the Saracens are beginning to overrun Spain, so the wild Northmen are on our coasts, and the wild Irishmen. In the end, no doubt the Saracens will be good for Spain, even as the Saxons have been good for this land.
Good for this land?
Arthur looked at the younger man in astonishment.
What do I hear you say, nephew?
When the Romans left us, my lord Arthur, we were isolated at the end of the world, alone with the half-savage tribes. The war with the Saxons forced us to reach beyond ourselves, he said. We had trade with Less Britain and with Spain and the countries to the south. We had to barter for weapons and horses. We built new cities. Why, here's your own Camelot, sir, to show that.
I do not even speak of the movement of the priests, who now have come among the Saxons, and made them no longer wild tribesmen with hair on their faces, worshipping their own barbarian gods, but civilized men, with cities and trade of their own, and their own civilized kings who are subject to you. For what else has this whole land been waiting? Now even they have monasteries and learned men writing books, and much more. Without the wars against the Saxons, my lord Arthur, Uther's old kingdom would have been forgotten like that of Maximus.
Arthur said with a glimmer of amusement,
Then, no doubt, you think these 20 years and more of peace have endangered Camelot, and we need more wars and fighting to bring us into the world again. It's easy to see you're not a warrior, young man. I have no such romantic view of war as that.
Gwydion smiled back.
What makes you think I'm not a warrior, my lord? I fought among your men, against Lucius, who would have been emperor, and I had ample time to make up my own mind about wars and their worth. Without wars, you would be more forgotten than the least of those kings in Wales and in Eire. Who now can call the roll of the kings of Tara?
And you think one day it may be so with Camelot, my boy?
Ah! My uncle and my king. Would you have the wisdom of a druid, or the flattery of a courtier?
Arthur said, laughing,
Let us have the crafty counsel of a Mordred. The courtier would say, my lord, that the reign of Arthur will live for ever, and his memory be for ever green in the world. And the druid would say that all men perish, and one day they will be, with all of their wisdom and their glories, like unto Atlantis, sunken beneath the waves. The gods alone endure. And what would my nephew and my friend say, then?
Your nephew?
He put just enough emphasis on the word that Guinevere could hear that it should have been your son.
Would say, my uncle and my lord, that we are living for this day, and not for what history may say of us 1,000 years hence. And so your nephew would advise that your stable should once again reflect the noble days when Arthur's horses and his fighting men were known and fearful to all. No man should be able to say, The king grows old, and with all his knights on quest, cares nothing to keep his men and horses in fighting trim.
Arthur gave him a friendly clap on the shoulder.
So let it be, dear boy. I trust your judgment. Send to Spain, or to Africa, if you will, for horses such as best suit the reputation of Arthur's legion, and see to their training.
I shall have to find Saxons for that, said Gwydion,
and the Saxons know little of our secrets of fighting a horse. You have always said they should not. Is it your will that since the Saxons are our allies now, they should be trained in our fighting skills?
Arthur looked troubled.
I fear I must leave that too in your hands. I shall try to do my best for you, Gwydion said. And now, my lord, we have sat over long in this talk and wearied the ladies. Forgive me, madam, he added, inclining his head to Guinevere with that winning smile. Shall we have music? The Lady Ninian, I'm certain, would be happy to bring her harp and sing to you, my lord and my king. I'm always happy to hear my kinswoman's music, said Arthur gravely, if it is pleasing to my lady.
Guinevere nodded to Ninian, who fetched her harp and sat before them, singing. And Guinevere listened with pleasure to the music. Ninian played beautifully, and her voice was sweet, though not so pure or strong as Morgaine's. But as she watched Gwydion, his eyes on Taliesin's daughter, she thought, "Why is it that we, a Christian court, must always have here one of those damsels of the Lady of the Lake?" It worried her, although Gwydion seemed as good a Christian as anyone else at court, coming always to Mass on Sunday, as did Ninian herself. For that matter, she couldn't remember how Ninian had come to be one of her ladies, save that Gwydion had brought her to court and asked the Queen to extend her hospitality as a kinswoman of Arthur and as Taliesin's daughter. Guinevere had only the kindest memories of Taliesin, and had been pleased to welcome his daughter, but somehow it seemed now that without ever putting herself forward, Ninian had assumed the place of the first among her ladies. Arthur always treated her with favour, and often called to her to sing, and there were times when Guinevere, watching them, wondered if he looked on her as more than kinswoman. But no, surely not. If Ninian had a paramour here at court, it was more than likely to be Gwydion himself. She had seen him look at her. And yet her heart grew sore within her. This woman was fair, fair as she herself had been, and she was but an ageing woman with her hair fading, the colour gone from her cheeks, her body sagging. And so, when Ninian had put up her harp and withdrawn, she frowned as Arthur came to escort her from the hall. "You look weary, my wife. What ails you?"
"Gwydion said you were old."
"My own dear wife, I have sat on that throne of Britain for 31 years, with you at my side. Do you think there is anyone in this kingdom who can still call us young? Most of our subjects weren't yet born when we came to the throne. Though indeed, my dear, I know not how it is that you look ever so young."
"Oh, my husband, I wasn't seeking to be praised," she said impatiently.
"You should be flattered, my Gwen, that Gwydion doesn't deal in empty flattering to an ageing king, cozening me with lying words. He speaks honestly, and I value him for it. I wish—"
"I know what you wish," she interrupted him, her voice angry. "You wish you could acknowledge him your son, so that he, and not Galahad, might have your throne after you."
He coloured. "Guinevere, must we always be so sharp with each other on this subject? The priests would not have him for king, and there's an end of it."
"I cannot but remember whose son he is."
"I cannot but remember that he is my son," said Arthur gently.
"I trust not Morgaine, and you yourself have found that she—" His face grew hard, and she knew that he wouldn't hear her on this one subject.
"Guinevere, my son was fostered by the Queen of Lothian, and her sons have been the support and stay of my kingdom. What would I have done without Gareth and Gawain? And now Gwydion stands fair to be like them, kindest and best of friends and companions. It will not make me think the less of Gwydion that he stood beside me when all my other companions forsook me for this quest."
Guinevere didn't want to quarrel with him. She said now, sliding her hand into his, "Believe me, my lord, I love you beyond all else on this earth."
"Why, I believe you, my love," he said. "The Saxons have a saying, that man is blessed who has a good friend, a good wife, and a good sword.
and all those have I, my Guinevere.
Oh, the Saxons, she said, laughing. All those years you fought against them, and now you quote their sayings of wisdom.
Well, what is the good of war, as Gwydion says, if we cannot learn wisdom from our enemies? Long ago, someone, Gawain perhaps, said something about the Saxons and the learned men in their monasteries. He said, it is like to a woman who is raped, and yet, after the invaders have left our coasts, bears a good son. Is it better to have had only the evil, or, when the evil is done and there's no mending it, to take what good may come from that evil?
Guinevere frowned and said, only a man, I think, could make such a jest as that.
No, I meant not to bring up old sorrows, dear heart, he protested. But the harm was done for me and Morgaine years ago.
She realized that for once he spoke his sister's name without that cold tightening in his face.
Would it be better that no good of any kind should come from the sin I did with Morgaine? For you will have it that it was sin. Or should I be grateful that since the sin was done, and there's no going back to innocence, God has given me a good son in return for that evil?
Morgaine and I parted not as friends,
and I know not where she is, or what has befallen her.
Nor do I suppose I will ever again look upon her face this side of the day of judgment.
But her son is now the very stay of my throne. Should I mistrust him because of the mother who gave him birth?
Guinevere would have said, I do not trust him because he was reared in Avalon. But she had no wish to, so she held her peace. But when, at her door, Arthur held her hand and asked softly,
Is it your will that I join you this night, lady?
She avoided his eyes and said, No, no, I am tired. She tried not to see the look of relief in his eyes. She wondered if it were Ninian or some other who shared his bed these days. She wouldn't stoop to question his chamberlain. If it is not I, why should I care who it might be? The year moved on into the darkness of winter, and on towards spring. One day Guinevere said fiercely, I wish this quest were done, and the knights returned, Grail or no Grail.
Hush, my dear, they are sworn, said Arthur.
But later that day, indeed, a knight rode up the track to Camelot, and they saw that it was Gawain.
Is it you, cousin?
Arthur embraced him and kissed him on either cheek.
I had no hope of seeing you till a year was done. Did you not swear to follow the Grail for a year and a day?
I did so, said Gawain. But I'm not false to my oath, lord. And yonder priest needn't look at me as if I were forsworn. For I last saw the Grail here, in this very castle, Arthur. And I am just as like to see it here again as in this corner or that of the world. I rode up and down, hither and thither, and never did I hear word of it more. And one day it came to me that I might as well seek it where I had seen it already, at Camelot, and in the presence of my king, even if I must look for it every Sunday on the altar at Mass, and nowhere else.
Arthur smiled and embraced him, and Guinevere saw that his eyes were wet.
Come in, cousin, he said simply. Welcome home.
And some days later, Gareth, too, came home.
I had a vision indeed, and I think it may have come from God, he said, as they sat at supper in the hall. I dreamed I saw the Grail uncovered and fair before me. And then a voice spoke to me from the light around the Grail and said, Gareth, companion of Arthur, this is all you will ever see of that Grail in this life. Why seek further for visions and glories when your king has need of you in Camelot? You may serve God when you reach heaven, but while you live here on earth, return to Camelot and serve your king.
And when I woke, I remember that even Christ had said that they should render unto Caesar those things which belong to Caesar.
and so I came home this way. And I met with Lancelot as I rode, and I bade him do the same.
"Do you think, then, that you truly found the Grail?" Gwydion asked.
Gareth laughed.
"Perhaps the Grail itself is only a dream. And when I dreamed of the Grail, it bade me to do my duty to my lord and king."
"I suppose we shall look to see Lancelot here among us soon, then."
"I hope he can find it in his heart to come," said Gawain, "for indeed we need him here. But Easter will be upon us soon, and then we can look to have them all come home."
Later, Gareth asked that Gwydion would bring his harp and sing for them.
"For," he said, "I've not heard even such rough music as I would hear at the court of the Saxons. And you, who sit here at home, have surely had time to perfect your songs, Gwydion."
Guinevere wouldn't have been surprised had he stood aside for Ninian, but instead he brought out a harp Guinevere recognised. "Is that not Morgaine's harp?"
"It is so. She left it at Camelot when she went from here, and if she wants it, she can send for it, or come and take it from me. And until that day, well, it is surely mine, and I doubt she would begrudge me this when she has given me nothing else." "Save only your life," said Arthur, in a tone of mild reproof, and Gwydion turned on him such a look of bitterness that Guinevere was sorely distressed. His savage tone couldn't be heard 4 feet away.
"Should I then be grateful for that, my lord and my king?"
Before Arthur could speak, he set his fingers to the strings and began to play. But the song he sang shocked Guinevere. He sang the ballad of the Fisher King, who dwelt in a castle at the middle of a great wasteland. And as the king grew ancient and his powers waned, so did the land fade and put forth no crops, till some younger man should come and strike the stroke of mercy, which would pour out the blood of the ancient king upon the land. Then the land would grow young again with the new king, and bloom with his youth.
"Say you so?" demanded Arthur uneasily. "That the land where an old king rules can only be a land which fades?"
"Not so, my lord. What would we do without the wisdom of your many years? Yet in the ancient days of the tribes it was even so, where the goddess of the land alone endures, and the king rules while he shall please her. And when the king stag grew old, another would come from the herd and throw him down. But this is a Christian court, and you have no such heathen ways as that, my king. But I think perhaps that ballad of the Fisher King is but a symbol of the grass, which, even as it says in your scriptures, is like to man's flesh, enduring but a season, and the king of the wasteland but a symbol of the world, which yearly dies with the grass, and is renewed with spring, as all religions tell. Even Christ withered like the Fisher King when he died the death of the cross, and returns again with Easter, ever new."
And he touched the strings and sang softly. "For lo, all the days of man are as a leaf that is fallen, and as the grass that withereth. Thou too shalt be forgotten, like the flower that falleth on the grass, like the wine that is poured out and soaks into the earth. And yet, even as the spring returns, so blooms the land, and so blooms life which will come again." Guinevere asked, "Is that scripture, Gwydion? A verse, perhaps, of a psalm?"
Gwydion shook his head. "It is an ancient hymn of the Druids, and there are those who say it is older than that, brought perhaps from those lands which now lie beneath the sea. But each religion has some such hymn as that. Perhaps, indeed, all religion is one."
Arthur asked him quietly,
"Are you a Christian, my lad?"
Gwydion didn't answer for a moment. At last he said,
"I was reared a Druid, and I do not break the oaths I have sworn. My name is not Kevin, my king. But you do not know all the vows I have made."
Quietly he rose from his place and went forth from the hall.
Arthur, staring after him, didn't speak even to reprove his lack of courtesy.
But Gawain was scowling.
"Will you let him take leave with so little of ceremony, Lord?"
"Oh, leave it, leave it," Arthur said. "We are all kinsmen here. I ask not that he should treat me always as if I were on the throne. He knows well that he is my son, and so does every man in this room. Would you have him always the courtier?"
But Gareth was frowning after him. He said softly,
"I wish with all my heart that Galahad would return to court. God grant him some such vision as mine, for you need him more here than you need me, Arthur. And if he comes not soon, I shall go forth myself to seek him."
It was only a few days before Pentecost when Lancelot finally came home. They had seen the approaching procession, men, ladies, horses and pack animals, and Gareth, at the gates, had summoned all men to welcome them. But Guinevere, standing at Arthur's side, paid little heed to Queen Morgawse, except to wonder why the Queen of Lothian had come. Lancelot knelt before Arthur with his sorrowful news, and Guinevere, too, felt the pain in his eyes. Always, always it had been like this, that what smote his heart was like a lash laid to her own. Arthur bent and raised Lancelot to his feet and embraced him, and his own eyes were wet.
"I have lost a son, no less than you, dear friend. He will be sorely missed."
And Guinevere could bear it no more, and stepped forward to give Lancelot her hand before them all, and say, her voice trembling, "I had longed for you to return to us, Lancelot, but I'm sorry that you must come with such sad news." Arthur said quietly to his men,
"Let him be taken to the chapel where he was made knight. There let him lie, and tomorrow he shall be buried as befits my son and heir."
As he turned away, he staggered a little, and Gwydion was quick to put his hand beneath his arm and support him. Guinevere didn't often weep now, but she felt she must weep at Lancelot's face, so marred and stricken. What had befallen him in this year when he followed the Grail? Long sickness, long fasting, weariness, wounds? Never had she seen him so sorrowful, even when he came to speak with her of his marriage to Elaine. Watching Arthur leaning heavily on Gwydion's arm, she sighed, and Lancelot pressed her hand and said softly,
"I can even be glad now that Arthur came to know his own son and to value him. It will soften his grief."
Guinevere shook her head, not wanting to think of what this would mean for Gwydion and for Arthur. Morgaine's son! Morgaine's son to follow after Arthur! No, there was no help for it now. Gareth came and bowed before her and said,
"Madam, my mother is here."
And Guinevere recalled that she wasn't free to stay among the men, that her place was with the ladies, that she couldn't speak a word of comfort to Arthur, or even to Lancelot. She said coldly, "I am happy to welcome you, Queen Morgawse." And it came to her mind, "Must I confess this then as a sin, that I lie to the Queen? Would it somehow be more virtuous if I said to her, 'I welcome you as duty demands, Queen Morgawse, but I'm not glad to see you, and I wish you had stayed in Lothian, or in hell for all I care.'" She saw that Ninian was at Arthur's side, that Arthur was between her and Gwydion, and she frowned. "Lady Ninian," she said coolly, "I think that the women will withdraw now. Find a guest room for the Queen of Lothian, and see that everything is made ready for her." Gwydion looked angry, but there was nothing to be said, and Guinevere reflected, as she and her ladies left the courtyard, that there were advantages to being a queen. All that day the companions and knights of the Round Table were riding back toward Arthur's court, and Guinevere was busy with the preparation for the feast on the morrow, which would be the funeral. On the day of Pentecost,
such of Arthur's men as had returned from this quest would be reunited. She recognized many faces, but some, she knew, would never return. Percival and Bors and Lamorack. She turned a gentler face on Morgause, who, she knew, sincerely mourned for Lamorack. She had felt that the older woman had made a fool of herself with her young lover. But grief was grief. And when, at the funeral mass for Galahad, the priest spoke of all those others who had fallen on this quest, she saw Morgause hiding tears behind her veil, and her face was red and blotched after the mass. The night before, Lancelot had watched by his son's body in the chapel, and she had had no chance for private words with him. Now, after the funeral mass, she bade him sit beside her and Arthur at dinner, and when she filled his cup, she hoped that he would drink himself drunk and be past mourning. She grieved over his lined face, so drawn with pain and privation, and over the curls around his face, so white now. And she, who loved him best, she couldn't even embrace him and weep with him in public. For many years she had felt it like a deep pain that she would never have any right to turn to him before other men, but must sit at his side and be only a kinswoman and his queen. And now it seemed to her more dreadful than ever, but he didn't turn to her. He didn't even meet her eyes. Standing, Arthur drank to the knights who would never return from the quest. "Here, before you all, I swear that none of their wives or children shall ever know want while I live, and Camelot stands with one stone upon another," he said. "I share your sorrow. The heir to my throne died in the quest of the Grail." He turned and held out his hand to Gwydion, who came slowly to his side. He looked younger than he was, in a plain white tunic, his dark hair caught in a golden band. Arthur said, "A king cannot, like other men, indulge in long mourning, my companions. Here I ask you to mourn with me for my lost nephew and adopted son, who now will never reign at my side. But even though our mourning is still green, I ask you to accept Gwydion, Sir Mordred, the son of my only sister, Morgaine of Avalon, as my heir. Gwydion is young, but he has become one of my wise counsellors." He raised his cup and drank. "I drink to you, my son, and to your reign when mine is done." Gwydion came and knelt before Arthur. "May your reign be long, my father." It seemed to Guinevere that he was blinking back tears, and she liked him better for it. The companions drank, and then, led by Gareth, broke out in cheering. But Guinevere sat silent. She had known this must come, but she hadn't expected it to happen at Galahad's very funeral feast. Now she turned to Lancelot and whispered, "I wish he had waited. I wish he had consulted with his counsellors." "Knew you not he intended this?" Lancelot asked. He reached out and took her hand, pressing it softly and holding on to it, stroking her fingers beneath the ring she wore. Her fingers seemed now so thin and bony, not young and soft as they had been. She felt abashed and would have drawn her hand away, but he wouldn't let her. He said, still stroking her hand, "Arthur should not have done that to you without warning." "God knows, I have no right to complain, who could not give him a son, so he must make do with more gains."
"Still, he should have warned you," Lancelot said.
It was the first time Guinevere thought distantly that he had ever, even for a moment, seemed to criticize Arthur. He raised her hand gently to his lips, then let it go as Arthur approached them with Gwydion. Stewards were bringing in smoking platters of meat, trays of fresh fruits and hot breads, setting sweetmeats every few places along the table. Guinevere let her steward help her to some meat and fruits, but she barely touched her plate. She saw with a smile that it had been arranged that she shared her plate with Lancelot, as so often she had done at other Pentecost feasts.
and that Ninian, on Arthur's other side, was eating from his dish. Once he called her daughter, which relieved Guinevere's mind somewhat. Perhaps he accepted her already as his son's potential wife. To her surprise, Lancelot seemed to follow her thought.
"Will the next festival at court be a wedding? I would have thought the kinship too close."
"Would that matter in Avalon?" Guinevere asked, her voice harsher than she intended. The old pain was still there. Lancelot shrugged.
"I know not. In Avalon, as a boy, I heard of a country far to the south of here, where the royal house married always their own sister and brother, that the royal blood might not be diluted by that of the common people, and that dynasty lasted for 1,000 years.
"Heathen men," said Guinevere. "They knew nothing of God, and knew not that they sinned."
Yet Gwydion seemed not to have suffered from the sin of his mother and his father.
Why should he? Taliesin's grandson. No, his great-grandson. Hesitate to wed with Taliesin's daughter. "God will punish Camelot for that sin," she thought suddenly. "For Arthur's sin, and for mine, and Lancelot's." Beyond her, she heard Arthur say to Gwydion,
"You said once in my hearing that Galahad looked not like one who would live to his crowning." "And you remember too, my father and my lord," said Gwydion quietly, "that I swore to you I would have no part in his death, but that he would die honourably for the cross he worshipped. And it was so." "What more do you foresee, my son?"
"Ask me not, Lord Arthur. The gods are kind when they say that no man may know his own end. Even if I knew, and I say not that I know, I would tell you nothing."
"Perhaps," thought Guinevere with a sudden shiver, "God has punished us enough for our sin when he sent us this Mordred." And then, looking at the young man, she was dismayed. "How can I think so of the one who has been to Arthur as a son indeed? He is not to blame for his fathering." She said to Lancelot, "Arthur shouldn't have done this before Galahad was cold in his grave."
"Not so, my lady. Arthur knows well the duties of a king. Do you think it would matter to Galahad where he has gone? Who sits on the throne he never wished for? I would have done better to make my son a priest, Guinevere."
She looked at Lancelot, brooding, 1,000 leagues away from her, gone into himself, where she could never follow. And she said awkwardly, reaching for him in the best way she could, "And did you, then, fail to find the Grail?" She saw him come slowly back through the long distance.
"I came nearer than any sinful man can come and live. But I was spared to tell the men at Arthur's court that the Grail has gone for ever beyond this world."
Again he fell silent, then said across that vast distance,
"I would have followed it beyond the world, but I was given no choice."
She wondered, "Did you not then wish to return to court for my sake?" And it seemed clear to her that Lancelot was more like Arthur than she had ever known, and that she had never been anything more to either of them than a diversion between war and quest, that the real life of a man was lived in a world where love meant nothing. All his life he had devoted to wars at Arthur's side, and now, when there was no war, he had given himself over to a great mystery. The Grail had come between them, as Arthur had come between them, and Lancelot's own honour. Now even Lancelot had turned to God, and thought, no doubt, only that she had led him into grave sin. The pain was unendurable. In all of life, she had had nothing more than this, and she couldn't keep herself from reaching out to him, clasping his hand. "I have longed for you," she whispered, and was shocked at the longing in her voice. "He will think me no better than Morgause, flinging myself at his head." He held her hand and said softly,
and I have missed you, Gwen.
And then, as if he could read her whole hungry heart, he said in a low voice,
Grail or no Grail, beloved, nothing could have brought me back to this court but the thought of you. I would have remained there, spending the rest of my life in prayers that I might see again that mystery that was hidden from my eyes. But I am no more than a man, my beloved.
And she knew what it was that he was saying, and pressed his hand. Shall I send away my women, then? He hesitated a moment, and Guinevere felt the old dread. How dared she be so forward, so lacking in a woman's modesty? Always this moment was like death. Then he tightened his grip on her fingers and said,
Yes, my love.
But as she awaited him, alone in the darkness, she wondered in bitterness if his yes had been like Arthur's, an offer made from time to time out of pity, or a wish to save her pride. Now that there was no longer the slightest hope that she would bear to Arthur a belated child, he could have stopped coming to her, but he was too kind to give her women cause to smile behind her back. Still, it was like a knife in her heart that Arthur always seemed relieved when she sent him away. There were even times when she invited him in, and they talked together, or she lay for a time in his arms, content to be held and comforted, but demanding no more of him. Now she wondered if Arthur felt that his embraces would be unwelcome to her, so that he seldom offered them, or whether he truly didn't desire her. She wondered if he ever had desired her, or had always come to her because she was the wife he had taken, and it was his duty to give her children. All men praised my beauty and desired me, save for the husband I was given. And now, she thought, perhaps even Lancelot comes to me because he is too kind to abandon me or turn me away. She grew feverish, and it seemed that even in her light bedgown she was overheated, her whole body breaking out in drops of sweat. She rose and sponged herself with the cold water in a jar on her dressing table, touching her sagging breasts with distaste. Oh, I am old. Surely it will disgust him that this ugly old flesh is still as eager for him as if I were young and beautiful. And then she heard his step behind her, and he caught her into his arms, and she forgot her fears. But after he had gone, she lay wakeful. I should not risk this. It was different in the old days. Now we are a Christian court, and the eyes of the bishop are always on me. But I have nothing else. And it occurred to her suddenly, nor has Lancelot. His son was dead, and his wife, and the old closeness with Arthur was gone beyond recall. Would that I were like Morgaine, who doesn't need a man's love to feel herself alive and real. And yet Guinevere knew that even if she didn't need this from Lancelot, it was he who needed her, and without her he would be utterly alone. He had come to court because he needed her no less than she needed him. And so, even if it was a sin, it seemed the greater sin to leave Lancelot comfortless. Even if we are both damned for it, she thought, never shall I turn aside from him. God is a God of love, she thought. How then could he condemn the one thing in her life that was born of love? And if he did, she thought, terrified at her blasphemy, he was not the God she had always worshipped, and she didn't care what he thought. Chapter 15. That summer there was war again, the Northmen raiding the western coasts, and Arthur's legion rode forth to battle, this time riding at the head of the Saxon kings from the southern country, Chadig and his men. Queen Morgawse remained in Camelot. It wasn't safe to take the road alone to Lothian, and none could be spared to escort her. They returned late in the summer. Morgawse was in the woman's hall with Guinevere and her ladies when they heard the trumpets from the heights.
"It is Arthur returning." Guinevere rose from her seat. Immediately all of the women dropped their spindles and clustered around her. "How do you know?"
Guinevere laughed. "A messenger brought me the news last night," she said. "Do you think I'm dealing in sorcery at my age?"
She looked around her at the excited girls.
To Morgause it seemed that all of Guinevere's ladies were but little girls, 14 and 15, who made every excuse to leave off spinning. And now the queen said indulgently, "Shall we go and watch them from the heights?"
Chattering, giggling, gathering in groups of 2 and 3, they ran off, leaving the dropped spindles where they had fallen. Good-naturedly, Guinevere called one of the serving women to put the room to rights, and, at Morgause's side, followed at a more dignified pace to the brow of the hill, where they could see the wide road leading up to Camelot.
"Look, there is the king,
and Sir Mordred riding at his side,
and there is the Lord Lancelot.
Oh, look, he has a bandage round his head, and his arm is in a sling."
"Let me see," said Guinevere, and pushed them aside, while the girls stared. Morgause could make out Gwydion riding at Arthur's side. He appeared unwounded, and she drew a sigh of relief. She could see Cormac back among the men, too. He had ridden to war with all the men, and he too seemed unhurt. Gareth was easy to find among them. He was the tallest man in Arthur's whole company, and his fair hair blazed like a halo. Gawain, too, at Arthur's back, as always, was upright in his saddle. But as they came nearer, she could see a great bruise on his face, darkening his eyes, and his mouth swollen, as if he had had a tooth or two knocked out.
"Look, Sir Mordred is handsome," one of the little girls said. "I have heard the Queen say that he looks exactly as Lancelot did when Lancelot was young."
And then she giggled and dug her neighbour in the ribs. They clung together, whispering, and Morgause watched, sighing. They seemed so young, all of them, so pretty with their hair silky soft and bound in plaits and curls, brown or red or golden, with their cheeks soft as petals and smooth as a baby's, their waists so slim, their hands so smooth and white. She felt suddenly wild with jealousy. Once she had been more beautiful than any of them. Now they were nudging one another, whispering about this knight and that.
"Look how the Saxon knights are all bearded. Why do they want to look shaggy like dogs?"
"My mother says," one of the maidens said impudently. She was the daughter of one of the Saxon noblemen. Her name was something barbarian, which Morgause could hardly pronounce. Alfrith, or something of that sort. "That to kiss a man without a beard is like kissing another maiden, or your baby brother."
"Yet Sir Mordred shaves his face clean, and there's nothing maidenly about him," said one of the girls,
and turned to Ninian, standing quietly among the women.
"Is there, Lady Ninian?"
Ninian said with a soft laugh, "All these bearded men seem old to me. When I was a little girl, only my father and the oldest druids ever went bearded."
"Even Bishop Patricius now wears his beard," said one of the girls. "I heard him say that in heathen times men deformed their faces by cutting their beards, and men should wear their beards as God made them. Maybe the Saxons think it so."
"It is but a new fashion," said Morgause. "They come and they go. When I was young, Christian and pagan alike shaved their faces clean, and now the fashion has changed. I think not it has anything to do with holiness either way. I doubt not one day Gwydion will wear a beard. Will you think less of him, Ninian?"
The younger woman laughed. "No, cousin. He is the same, bearded or shaven."
"Oh, look! There rides King Chardig and others. Are they all to be guested here at Camelot? Madam, shall I go and tell the stewards?"
"Please do, my dear," Guinevere said, and Ninian moved toward the hall. The girls were shoving one another to get a better view, and Guinevere said,
"Come, come, all of you, back to your spinning. It is unseemly to stare at young men this way. Have none of you anything better to do than talk so immodestly about the men? All of you now, be off with you. You will see them this night in